First of all, thank you so much for inviting us. We're very excited to be here. As English is not our first language, we'll have to use a manuscript. I hope it will be okay with you. This talk will be based on our master's thesis about the Danish research on testosterone and the association that has been made between testosterone and masculinity. We will talk for approximately 1 hour, and then we will have a discussion afterwards. But if there's anything that is unclear, or you have some questions on how to understand different things in our talk, you're welcome to ask us about it during the presentation. Also, if we are speaking too fast, you can just say so, or maybe wave your hand if we're talking too fast. As you can see from the title, we have examined how different concepts of masculinity have been constructed in research projects about testosterone in Denmark from the 1910s to the 1980s. Our source material has been different research publications from the natural sciences, primarily medical dissertations and peer-reviewed articles. Maybe we should say actually also that we have studied history and philosophy. And it's a project within the history of medicine, you could say, and the philosophy of science. So we're not biologists or something like that. we have looked at these publications from the natural sciences, and the aim of our study has not been to define what testosterone is or which kinds of effects it has in bodies, and we're not going to make any claims about these issues in our talk. Our main interest has been to examine how research on testosterone has been communicated to other researchers and the public, and to analyze how and why different researchers have ascribed different gendered meanings to testosterone, and how these conceptions have developed over time in relation to the production of knowledge within research on sex hormones. And in this talk, we will first present our theoretical point of departure and define the three most important concepts we have used in the project, which are gender, testosterone, and masculinity. And then we will present our historical case studies afterwards. We have two central questions, which we will discuss in the presentation, which are how and why testosterone and masculinity have been connected to each other in Danish scientific research projects about testosterone from the 1910s to the 1980s. And also which consequences this connection has had for gender norms in the Danish society and for the view on the medical treatment of groups of people of different genders and sexual orientations.
Yes. An important part of this study has been to discuss if and how we could include the biological body in our conception of gender without losing a constructivist perspective and become essentialistic, reductionistic, or deterministic. And this is, of course, a very large subject, and we could talk on and on about that. But we don't have time for that here, so we'll just briefly say that in our study, we have not viewed gender as something that has an ontological existence. That is, we do not view gender as a concrete material thing in the world you can point out. Instead, we have viewed gender as a concept which you associate with different entities in the world, for instance, genitals or certain chromosome variations, or which you use to explain different phenomena, for instance, people's different habits or wishes. Furthermore, we've been inspired by the understanding of gender within so-called developmental systems theory. Developmental systems theory was a perspective originally developed within biology, and we were introduced to it by reading the American biologist and feminist scholar Anne Fausta Sterling, who some of you may know, and if you don't, I will very much recommend her. And according to the developmental systems theory, the development of different elements which have traditionally been associated with gender happen in a complex interaction between biological, psychological, and social levels. And these developments happen simultaneously in this theory. They say that these developments happen simultaneously on all levels, and no level can be said to be more primary than others or to determine the development of other parts of the system. So psychological and social phenomena should therefore not be seen as caused by or reducible to biological processes or vice versa. The psychological, social, and biological as categories or as analytical tools should be seen as different ways to describe and analyze a phenomenon, which is at the same time social, psychological, biological, and many other things. And consequently, this perspective eliminates the traditional distinction between mind and body and between sex and gender. And you might say it, you could also have used other perspectives like actor network theory or something that has a bit of the similarities with this one.
And we have combined this developmental systems theory with a queer theoretical approach. For us, this approach implies a critical perspective on a notion of gender, which focuses on people's reproductive potentials, and which describes heterosexual relations as natural, normal, and more desirable than non-heterosexual relations. We have used the queer theoretical perspective to put a critical focus on norms about gender and the idea that gender and reproduction is closely connected, which has been very central and common in our source material. Furthermore, we decided at an early point that we were not that when we were going to analyze the construction of concepts of masculinity in medical research, we would not focus exclusively on studies and treatments of men or on a certain minority group, for example, homosexuals. Instead, we wanted to use a focus on testosterone to create the possibility of examining how and in which ways both men, women, and persons who could not be characterized as belonging to either of these categories had been viewed and treated in different ways in accordance with different medical conceptions about which physical and psychological states were normal and abnormal or pathological for men and women.
And the reason why we choose testosterone as a focus point, or the immediate reason was for our analysis, was that for the last 70 or 80 years, testosterone has been used often as a causal explanation for appearances and behaviors that have been described as masculine. This explanation has both gained acceptance in scientific settings and in the public. In Denmark, and if you look at it internationally, I guess also here. In other words, testosterone has been and is understood by many to be the chemical essence with which makes a body and psyche male. In popular saying, you would say that it is what men are made of. And other suggestions for what might be the essential biological causes of masculinity have also appeared in this period. So she just mentioned them. Just for instance, the chromosome variation XY or certain genes. But testosterone has been a particularly popular explanation because of its ability to give a simple explanation of change. For instance, a high level of testosterone could be used as an explanation for masculine characteristics in non-male individuals, and variations in the explanation. Variations in the production of testosterone in an individual could explain how a masculine male in time could become less masculine. But researchers within the critical research on men and masculinities, a field that was founded in the 1970s on the basis of feminist theory, have developed other definitions and understandings of the concept of masculinity from a social constructivist point of view. R.W. Connell's concept of hegemonic masculinity is a sociological concept that seeks to capture modern social structures, and Connell defines it as a pattern of practices that ensures men's dominance over women. And the concept of manliness and unmanliness have been developed within Nordic historical research and are used to describe such psychological mechanisms in the social interaction between men, where men include or exclude each other by judging each other's ability to live up to local gender norms. And these definitions are quite different and also sometimes quite vague or not very precisely described. Furthermore, researchers inspired by queer theory have raised an important critique of the understanding of the concept of masculinity within the traditional sociological and historical research. Even though these researchers wanted to distance themselves from essentialist and determinist understandings of the concept masculinity, they sometimes inadvertently reproduced such understandings because the studies of masculinity were focused on groups of individuals defined as men and not including individuals who were defined as women or non-male in the theories, in the studies. And such an approach represents masculinity as something that is constructed entirely in interactions between real men or male bodies, which we do not think is the case.
Yeah. Because of this critique, and inspired by queer theoretical researchers such as the American literary scholar Judith Halberstam, the Swedish sociologist Marie Nordberg, and Swedish social anthropologist Britt-Marie Thurén, we have tried to define the concept of masculinity in a non-essentialistic way that does not refer to bodies with specific characteristics. Actually, we have chosen not to make a definition of what masculinity is, but instead we have chosen to define the concept on the basis of its linguistic function. We understand masculinity in the following way. We understand it as a concept which linguistically functions by associating persons, practices, objects, psychological and physiological characteristics, symbols, and other things with the category men. And to illustrate what we mean by this, we have made a couple of quite stereotypical examples of how this is done in everyday speech. When people say that, for example, they consider cars or penises, anger, abstract thought, and other things to be masculine, what they do is they connect these entities linguistically to the concept man or the category man. In this way, different notions of what the concept man contains and expectations of what a man is are constructed.
You could also comment now on, for instance, our clothes, which are quite similar, but you could maybe not agree upon who would be the more masculine. I mean, Marie-Louise has the largest biceps, I have the longest hair, I'm a bit taller, but Marie's is more heavy. I don't know. So you could, as a negotiation, you could do that.
And you could also say with the hair, in some context, you would consider very, very long the hair as you have on a man is very masculine, and other people would maybe consider it feminine, so
yeah,
it's something that is negotiated. The Swedish anthropologist Britt-Marie Thurén and other theorists within gender studies would call this to gender something, that you gender various entities, either masculine, for example, just as you linguistically are able to gender other or the same entities feminine in different contexts. Thurén and other researchers' analysis have shown that which elements are gendered and which are not is not a given. For example, you don't have to gender things. You can also ungender them and say, I think this has something to do with, this is masculine, and then you could say, oh, I don't think it has anything to do with gender, for example. It also varies historically and locally how entities are gendered in different social contexts. This points to the fact that statements about what is masculine and what is feminine are not neutral statements of facts about what people observe, but normative statements expressing how a person thinks that other people ought to look and behave when associated with a certain gender category. With this theoretical framework as a point of departure, we can rephrase our question and ask how and why testosterone has been gendered masculine in Danish and international research on sex hormones. We would now like to show you how this has been done by going into the history of this research.
Yes. Okay. So now the empirical things come up. The first part of this history of testosterone research concerns the early. No, sorry. The first part of this history concerns the early sex hormone research in Denmark in the 1910s and 1920s. In this period, hormones became the main focus of scientific sex research, and the conceptualization of male and female sex hormones began. One of the leading sex hormone researchers in Europe at the time was Danish coroner and sexual biologist Knud Sand, who was very inspired by some German scientists too. And he and other international sexual biologists were preoccupied with discovering the underlying cause of different kinds of sex development, physical as well as psychological. The sexual biologists, as they call themselves, based their assumptions on a hypothesis with historical roots from antiquity, that there had to be a substance in the genital organs, or more precise, the gonads, that is the testicles and the ovaries, of animals and humans, and that this substance determined an individual's development in an either male or female direction. But perhaps even more interesting for the researchers were the question why some individuals developed a mixture of traits they considered to be male and female.
Yeah, and we have a quotation from one of Knud Sand's articles, where he writes, "I'm interested in the large category of human beings who show more or less mixed sexual characters. It is the sexual intermediate stages where the sex is not sharply defined in every way, but where we find all possible kinds of transitions and combinations between the male and the female sex in both a bodily and a psychological sense."
And these so-called sexually abnormal conditions, as Sand also called the sexual intermediate stages, were considered to be pathological conditions. A development to either a pure male or a pure female were by the sexual biologists considered to be the end goal of a healthy, natural sexual development. And anything that differed from this logically had to be unhealthy and unnatural, and therefore in need of medical treatment. And this way of thinking can be seen as part of the predominant positivist ideals and tendencies from the late 19th century and the early 20th century, when researchers, as well as intellectuals and politicians in the Western world, began to focus on classifying humans in a number of ideally separate categories, namely race, gender, age, class, and moral constitution. In the wake of Darwin theory about the evolution of the species, interpretations and theories from other natural sciences and social sciences followed, saying that humanity consisted of different races which fought each other for resources and power, and where only the fittest would survive in the long run. So survival was claimed to be dependent on the ability for a race not to degenerate, that is, not that it did not fall back on an earlier step on the evolutionary ladder and be defeated by other stronger, more healthy, and more civilized races.
And this way of thinking was the basis of political eugenic interests and initiatives of that age when sex hormone research was founded in the 20s and 30s. And the Danish historian, among others, Lene Koch, have shown in their research about eugenics in Denmark and internationally that these initiatives were aimed at all kinds of persons who were characterized as showing degenerative traits. Individuals who, regarding race, class, or gender, were characterized as hybrid or on an intermediate stage, as Knud Sand called them, were defined as degenerated. In practice, this most often happened when an individual failed to live up to norms about how she or he was expected to look and behave according to the way she or he was characterized socially. This way of thinking was the basis of and reason why Sand and other sex development researchers were extremely interested in finding the cause for sexual development. Their research aimed at finding two substances that led to male and female development and their main goal was to make scientists able to control the sexual development of individuals so that the number of individuals with mixed sexual characters in society could be limited as much as possible. The researchers did not themselves consider this a political project, but instead they saw it as an exclusively medical project which would benefit society in general and more specifically the individuals suffering from abnormal sexual conditions. And we have a quote here about that, where Knud Sand, or in another, this is from his doctoral thesis, where he writes, "An important basis for the correct understanding and just assessment of both somatic and psychological abnormal sexual conditions is the detailed knowledge of the normal and abnormal conditions within the endocrine tissue of the gonads and the function hereof. In this way, not only the human and scientific understanding of these painful conditions grow, but one also sees the possibility, using the at the present moment available facts, to provide an effective treatment medically or surgically."
Now, the existence of a male hormone was for a long time only a hypothesis. Not until the 1930s did biochemists become able to isolate chemical substances which they defined as a sex hormone. Before that, the researchers tried to test and verify their hypothesis by doing experiments on the presumed place of production for the hormones, the testicles and ovaries. The experiments of Knud Sand and other sexual biologists therefore consisted of castrating, among other, infertile chickens, guinea pigs, which we have here, and rats. Then they transplanted different combinations of gonads into the animals, testicles into originally female guinea pigs, ovaries into male guinea pigs, or a combination of both ovaries and testicles to infantile hens or capons. A capon is a castrated male chicken. And this picture is also from Knud Sand's doctoral thesis, and it's a picture of a guinea pig that he has transplanted both ovaries and testicles into, so it has both a small penis and a small mammary gland.
We have some more hermaphroditic animals. According to Sand's research publications, the result of these experiments was that animals with testicles were masculinized. That is, they developed physical and sometimes also behavioral characteristics which were similar to the characteristics of non-operated males. Animals with ovaries were feminized, and animals with tissue from both testicles and ovaries developed a mixture of male and female characteristics. And here we see an example of this, two hermaphroditic fowls. The birds are now at the Medical Museum where you work in Copenhagen. And they are some of the original birds which Knud Sand was experimenting on. And if you know something about fowls, which I don't actually, but I've been told that, for example, you can see they're hermaphroditic, but the small one should be a hen, but you can see it has a large comb. It has developed a large comb, and the large one should originally have been a cock, and it has a much smaller comb than it would have normally, and also the feathers of the birds is a kind of mixture of male and female, and maybe you can see the hen has a larger tail than it would normally have, for example, and the fact that transplantations of testicles and ovaries could change the physical development of infantile animals was interpreted by the sexual biologists as a verification of the thesis that there was one hormone produced in the testicles which developed and controlled the development of individuals in a male direction, while a hormone in the ovary stimulated the development of female characteristics. Mixed sexual characteristics therefore had to be caused by a mixed hormonal tissue in the gonads of an individual producing both male and female hormones.
And we have another quote, from Knud Sand, from his doctoral thesis, where he says, "Because of irregular processes in the genetic factors, the normal development of either male or female characters is not always present. Between these two extremes, we find, also in the human being, all kinds of transitions, all kinds of different mixtures of male and female elements, both bodily and psychologically. Thus, the so-called hermaphroditic and other abnormal sexual conditions appear, phenomenons which are one of the most mysterious and interesting areas within sexual science. The sexual biologists considered homosexuality as one of these abnormal sexual conditions, and Sand claimed that you could explain the development of homosexuality on the basis of the hormonal theory. In this sense, on this logic, a change in hormonal production would, in this perspective, inevitably lead to a change in sexual development.
Here it goes. Yes. Yeah, Sand considered homosexuality to be a so-called psychosexual hermaphroditic condition. And we can illustrate what he meant by this model. We made it ourselves. and it's in Danish, unfortunately. We couldn't translate this part, but I'll explain it to you. On the top, we have a physical hermaphrodite, and below, you have the psychosexual hermaphrodite. And as you would expect, a physical hermaphrodite was considered to be an individual who had mixed hormonal tissue in its gonads, according to Sand's theory, and who, as an embryo, developed a body with a mixture of male and female characteristics. So you can see it has breasts and penis. And homosexuals were also considered to have a mixed hormonal tissue in the gonads. But Sand's thesis was that a homosexual man had a normal male hormone production as an embryo and until puberty, and as a consequence, he had developed a normal male body. However, after puberty, the hormone production in the gonads was supposed by Sand to have changed so that more female than male hormones were produced, and this he thought it would it affected the brain, the man's brain, in a feminizing way, so that he began to feel and think like a woman and to desire men. So you can see his thinking about a man. That's his sexual desire in his feminine psyche, and then he has the male body. So that's the hermaphroditic aspect of it, that the body is male, but his brain and his brain says and his psyche is female.
Yeah, which you can also find today in some of the more popular reports from neuroscience. The results of the experiments gave Sand and other sexual biologists the hope that they would be able to treat and cure so-called abnormal psychological and sexual intermediate stages by way of transplanting the gonads. For some years, researchers experimented on treating homosexual men by castrating them and transplanting healthy heterosexual testicles on them instead, hoping that a normal male hormonal production would cure them of their desire of men. The experiments were soon abandoned as they, in spite of early optimistic reports, didn't seem to have any effect. This happened actually both in Germany and in Denmark. I think it was Jürgen Steiner was the researcher here that Sand was inspired by. As you can...
Yeah.
Was he also?
This was still in the 1920s? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
In the middle of the
1920s. 1924, there's some experiments, I think.
Yeah. Well, as you can tell by these examples, biological researchers in the 1910s and 1920s claimed that there was a close connection between an individual's hormonal balance and the way an individual's body looked, and also its gender identity, sexual orientation, and sexual behavior. It was presumed that a large production of the so-called male hormone would lead to the development of a body with characteristics defined as male, that the same individual would feel like a man, behave masculine, and desire and have sex with women. And this presumption about a causal chain from the biological level to the psychological and social levels became the basis for the future research on sex hormones.
Around 1930, biochemists became able to extract a substance which they claimed to be the male hormone from thousands of liters of urine from men. A few years later, they were able to produce this substance chemically, and of course it was now much easier for them to study which different effects the male hormone had on the bodies and psyches of animals and human beings. During the 1930s, a number of new results which astounded researchers were produced. They seemed to undermine the thesis of the existence of a male and a female hormone as the primary cause for the development of male and female individuals. One of these results was that in 1934, the Dutch gynecologist Bernard Sondek reported that he had found large amounts of the female sex hormone in stallion's urine, that is the male horse. In fact, much larger amounts than had ever been found in mare's urine. And this report was followed by others that both female and male hormones were found could be found in both the urine of men and of women. Furthermore, other investigations showed that there was not only one male and one female hormone in urine, but a large number of different hormones which were chemically closely related. And you can see some of them here, and you can see that the chemical structure is really, really similar.
It also turned out that the adrenal glands, that the adrenal glands produced what had been defined as sex hormones, and that the production of hormones in the testicles and ovaries was interdependent with the production of other hormones in the pituitary gland, also called the hypophysis in the brain. Other results indicated that more than one hormone was involved in the development of physical traits associated with gender, and that not only male but also female hormones could stimulate the development of physical traits that were considered sex-specific for males. On the basis of these new results, some researchers began to question the idea about two sex-specific hormones, and one of them was the Danish physician Herman Nielsen.
And we have quite a long quote, but we think it's really good, so we wanted you to hear it all. He wrote, after B. Sondek have demonstrated that the so-called ovary hormone can be extracted in the largest quantities from the urine of stallions, both the ovarian and the feminine about these hormone preparations seem to be quite illusory. The premature use of the common name, the feminine sex hormone, for the hormones which can be extracted from, among other things, ovaries, resulted in the immediate idea that there must be another, an antagonistic male sex hormone, which possibly could be extracted from the male gonads, the testicles. Indeed, researchers succeeded in making an extract from testicles which had a certain male effect. It stimulated the growth of the atropic combs of capons. It was now believed that two antagonistic sex hormones had been found, one male and one female, and this belief was supported by the discovery of them in male and female sexual organs, and by the fact that you could stimulate biological reactions by using them, also in the female and the male sexual organs respectively, or in sexually specific organs like the comb of capons. These theories were applied to the human being and therapy. If a woman did not have enough womanliness, for instance, suffered from amenorrhea, that is absence of menstruation, she should simply be given some ovary hormone. And if a man had too little manliness, for instance, felt himself to be impotent, he should simply be given a little testicular hormone. However, it soon turned out that these biological reactions were not gender-specific in the strict sense. And then he mentions different examples. For example, the testicular extract could give feminine test reactions. The estrogen substance estrin affect male sexual organs, and the coxcomb is not exclusively affected by male hormones, and other examples. But exactly these experiments have been used as the only means of verifying these hormones, and the theories about these hormones are based upon the specificity of these experiments. Already here we see that something is fundamentally wrong with these theories.
Nielsen also emphasized that both male and female hormones could further the growth of organs like mammary glands, uterus, and male genitalia, effects which had been considered sex-specific hormonal effects. As the quotation shows, according to Nielsen, these aspects were ignored in the growing use of sex hormones for therapeutic treatments, where many physicians treated their patients according to the hormones' gendered associations. Since the link between the testis hormone and manliness, in a both biological and sexual sense, was connected to the presumption that the hormones were gender-specific in origin and effect, Nielsen thought that the therapeutic use of hormones was based on an over-hasty and wrongly concluded premise. He argued that it would actually be more correct to view the hormones as part of a whole metabolism rather than as hormones. From a chemical perspective, they could be said to belong to the same group called sterines. They were produced several different places in the body, could combine chemically to each other, and their production was regulated by the pituitary gland, by that gland's production of so-called gonadotropes, other hormones, all of which resembles the production of insulin that regulate the body's carbohydrate metabolism. However, this view on the hormones did not gain momentum, and Nielsen's article did not get any responses from other Danish physicians or sex hormone researchers in the medical journal.
Mm. And in the light of the new knowledge about the places where sex hormones were produced in the body and its different possible effects, there was a growing awareness in the international field of sex hormone research that the notions of male and female hormones were imprecise and inefficient. Consequently, international conferences were arranged in London in 1932 and 1935, and in Geneva in 1938, where researchers could discuss and decide how the hormones should be named. The discussion was especially influenced by the traditions of two different research fields in which hormones had been studied. Biochemists perceived hormones as catalysts which influenced different bodily processes and the growth of different kinds of tissue in the body. And these researchers claimed that you need not associate hormones specifically with sexual development. Biologists, on the other hand, perceived hormones as parameters from which you could classify animals as either male or female. At the conference in 1935, the biologists won the discussion, and it was decided that the hormones found in testicles and ovaries should still be defined as sex hormones. After some discussion and different suggestions, the hormones were named androgens and estrogens. This naming provided the substances with strongly gendered connotations, as androgen in direct translations means what makes a man, and estrogen what makes heat. The androgens were in this way associated with the category men, both through the naming and through the researchers' focus on the influence on development of the sexual organs, while estrogens were directly associated with reproduction. So hormones which were defined as estrogens got a name that started with estra, like estrin and so on, while hormones which were defined as androgens got a name that started with andro. The only exception was the androgen, which was named testosterone, where the name linguistically associated the substance directly with the testicles. The introduction of these concepts largely ended the debate of the time about whether you ought to associate these chemical substances exclusively with sexual development or not.
And in the following decades, new results kept appearing, which pointed to the fact that testosterone and other androgens, like estrogens, were not only connected to the development of sexual characteristics, but also played an important part in a number of other processes in human bodies, irrespective of gender categories. For instance, the salt and water metabolism, skin pigmentation, bone growth, and the construction of a muscular system. And as a Danish physician, Christian Hamburger, leader of the hormonal department at the government's Serum Institute in Copenhagen, wrote in 1947, "If all hormones which influence the development of the sexual characters and are important to reproduction are to be defined as sexual hormones, it is difficult to find a hormone which is not a sex hormone." So which substances to describe as sex hormones and which not to was, in other words, a choice that researchers had to agree upon at the new.
The following list is an overview of which conditions were mentioned in medical journals from the 1940s and 1950s, which physicians had tried to cure with doses of sex hormones. And we have examples of where the conditions have been treated with both testosterone and estrogen. And this overview illustrates the complex relationship between treatment and norms and how hard it is sometimes to distinguish between them. The physicians have on one hand tried to ease different kinds of physical pains when they were, for example, treating a patient with menstrual pains or with cryptorchism. Cryptorchism means that the testicles have not fallen down into the scrotum, but have remained in the abdominal cavity. But they were also trying to cure the psychological pains of, for example, depression or of male transvestism, which some men went to their physicians to be cured of. As all these conditions were often associated with sex, treating them with the sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen, made good sense to the physicians. Some of the treatments were reported to work as expected, while others did not have the desired effect or any effect at all on the conditions which the physicians tried to cure. Some of the conditions on which the treatment did not have any effect were, for example, male infertility and male transvestism. The point is that if the physicians had not regarded these chemical substances as sex hormones, then they would probably not have used them, but other methods or drugs when they were trying to cure the conditions. Simultaneously, with the aim of easing pain, many treatments of patients with sex hormones were also, or sometimes primarily, aimed at establishing or re-establishing a condition which was considered to be the normal sexual state of a patient, considering his or her gender category and age. For example, this is the case with the treatment of hypergenitalism, which is a term meaning that a man's genitals are too small, or infantilism, which is a term meaning that a body is not developed enough sexually, or that development is too slow. Other examples are hypersexuality, frigidity, and impotency, terms meaning that a person's libido is too strong or too weak, or that she or he has too many or too few sexual activities. And it is certainly the case with the diagnosis eunuchism, cryptorchism, and transvestitism, where patients are considered to be too unmanly or too feminine. In other cases, physicians chose to limit the uses of sex hormones in a treatment because of a patient's gender category and age. For example, they advised strongly against treating women with large doses of testosterone because this was reported to have a virilizing effect, which meant that, for example, women could get a deeper voice or acne, increased hair growth, growth of beard and clitoris, and smaller mammary glands. Such effects in female bodies was described as unwanted and socially stigmatizing, while the same effects in male bodies treated for the same condition was not described as unwanted. Christian Hamburger wrote in one of his articles that the treatment of women with large doses of testosterone could only be legitimized when they were treated for very serious and life-threatening conditions such as cancer. So this illustrates that physicians of the period can both be said to have tried to pay regard to social norms, that men and women ought to have different physical, sexual characteristics and behavior, and to legitimize these norms with their experiments with treatments.
A main purpose of the continued research about testosterone from the 1960s to the 1980s was to discover the correct dosage of testosterone to be given as treatment to various kinds of gendered individuals. Looking at this research, it becomes clear that the physicians perceived testosterone from two concurrent perspectives. First, as a chemical substance with a masculinizing effect. This effect was utilized in treatments of individuals characterized as men and avoided in treatments of individuals characterized as women. And second, testosterone was viewed as a drug with possible beneficial effects for individuals regardless of their gender category, for instance, by enhancing sexual feelings or desire. In the 1960s, more knowledge was produced within the areas of sex hormone research that focused on treatments. And research results showed that the chemically closely related androgen substances could convert to each other and to estrogen inside the body, and that testosterone was also produced via conversion processes in the liver, apart from the already known places of production in the testicles, ovaries, and adrenal glands. Furthermore, a part of the amount of testosterone found in blood was found to be tied up to protein molecules, and only the free testosterone was able to combine to the tissues of the body. The susceptibility of the bodily tissues was furthermore dependent on the age and additional physical condition, constitution of the individual. For instance, statistically, differences between blonde and dark-haired individuals was shown. And these, especially the last two results, challenged the hypothesis that the amount of testosterone in the blood was an indication of the effect that testosterone had in the body, and that a high amount of testosterone in itself produced masculine characteristics. So, but yeah, in 1967, in an article in a leading Danish medical journal, the Danish physician Jørgen Lindholm concluded from these results that testosterone figured in many and complex contexts, and that there was surprisingly much the physician did not know about the hormone yet. Among other things, its biological role in the female. And this last remark points to the fact that testosterone research had concentrated on individuals defined as men because the hormone had been associated with masculinity.
Another question which sex hormone researchers were trying to answer from the 1960s to the 1980s was what the relation was between chromosomes and hormones and what it meant in regard to sexual development. The prevailing theory about sexual development of the time within sexual hormone research described sexual development as a chain of causes where entities on some levels determine the development on other levels. We will illustrate the theory with this model, you can see in the PowerPoint. A so-called normal male sexual development has had as its basis the sex chromosomes XY, which were also spoken of as the true sex of an individual. That is, the chromosomes is the true sex. The chromosomes determined the differentiation of the gonads in a male direction, that is, they developed into testicles. The testicles produced one-third more testosterone than ovaries would do, and this caused a development of the different organs of the body in a male direction, and furthermore, it affected the man's behavior and psyche profoundly. This view on sexual development was the basis of the studies of the effect of sex hormones within sex chromosome research. The research on the connection between chromosome constitutions and physical and psychological features was boosted when the Swedish chromosome researchers developed a new method in 1956 by which they could make images of the chromosomes of an individual, so-called karyotypes. Medical scientists were particularly interested in studying so-called chromosomal abnormalities because previous studies had shown that many of these deviations resulted in uncommon formations of the body, and in some instances an intelligence below average could be measured. On basis of this, researchers who were studying sex chromosomes assumed that persons who had other variations of sex chromosomes than the most common chromosomal sexes XX or XY would be developed in an abnormal way, both physically and mentally. On the PowerPoint, you can see some of the other possibilities of chromosomal variations which have been found. The new method of making karyotypes was used by the researchers both to identify chromosomal deviations and to categorize individuals as either men or women.
Yeah, and in relation to gender characterization, individuals with the XXY chromosome constitution, the first one here, were a challenge for the medical establishment. For a long time, there had been discussions about whether these individuals were male or female, because they often developed a mixture of male and female gendered characteristics. Before 1956, when the karyotype was developed, researchers had considered them female because tests showed that they had a double X chromosome constitution, and they presumed that these individuals in their fetal state had developed a male body. After 1956, when karyotypes showed that these individuals had two X and one Y chromosome, the researchers changed their views and now consider them to be male individuals because of the Y chromosome. They were hereafter interpreted as boys who during puberty might develop female characteristics and did not develop certain male characteristics.
And apart from assuming that an XXY chromosome constitution led to the development of a number of physical deformities, the researchers were also interested in finding out if it led to lowered intelligence, as mentioned before, but also criminal behavior, which some of the early studies about individuals with this chromosome constitution had indicated. Some researchers found a high amount of persons with XXY, also XYY chromosomes in jails. The aim of a Danish research project done in the 1960s was to study which kinds of consequences the XXY chromosome constitution could have for individuals in regard to their physical development, and if the constitution was associated with the specific psychological and psychiatric problems. In this talk, we're only going to present the parts of the study which describe the connection between testosterone and the development of physical features, although the other part is also very interesting. This part of the research project was done by the physician Anders Frøland, which you can see down in the corner maybe, who compared individuals with an XXY chromosome constitution with so-called normal men who had XY chromosome constitution. From earlier studies, he knew that individuals with XXY chromosomes had a level of testosterone which, on average, was lower than the level of individuals with XY chromosomes. Therefore, his thesis was that a low production of testosterone must cause a physical development which differed from the development of normal males and a development of feminine physical features. And the overview you can see here can be characterized as an example of how sexual normality was defined in the 1960s from average norms. And for example, there's the normal men with the XY chromosomes, and then there are the abnormal men with the XXY sex chromosomes. You can see when you look at it, it really looks like really small differences. It's average differences. And you can see the first one is the urine excretion of testosterone, and the normal urine excretion for normal males, so-called normal males, is 5.44, between 5.44 and 36.73 milligrams per day. And for the abnormal men, it's 3.29 and 30.02. But you can also see there's a huge overlap, actually, because the normal range is really broad. But the average norms for the persons with XXY is much much closer to what you can measure in females. So they were discussing if it was kind of female steroid pattern these men had. And then there's the height of the men. The abnormal men are on average 3.5 centimeters taller than the normal men. And they have a shorter upper body. They have either no or very sparse facial hair on average. For example, you can see that by how many times per week they shave. Normal men should shave 5.5 times a week, while the abnormal men only shaves 3.8 times a week. Some of of the XXY persons can have developed breasts, while most of the normal men would have a flat chest, and they have quite smaller testicles than normal men, but a normal-sized penis, they also say. And then they have sparse feminine pubic hair, while the normal men have masculine pubic hair. And we actually spent a lot of time trying to find out what is a masculine pubic hair growth. And it's really hard to find out, but we think it is that you have hair growth from the navel and down to the pubic bone. That should be the difference.
Yes. But as we said, these results were of average differences between test subjects when the researcher divided them into two groups according to their sex chromosome constitution. But Folland also noted that individuals with XXY chromosomes rarely were considered different from other men in a social context. The two groups of test subjects were in practice very difficult to distinguish from each other since their appearances varied so much. Some individuals with XXY chromosomes were not so tall, had big beards and no breast development, while some individuals with XY chromosomes had breasts and very little growth of beard, etc. So Freudan investigated whether or not there were any connection between certain levels of testosterone and the development of certain physical and psychological characteristics, but he could not find any statistically significant correlations. And this result challenged the hypothesis of both himself and other sex hormone researchers that the level of testosterone determined the appearance and behavior of an individual. In the 1980s, results like these and the ones we mentioned earlier, resulted in new formulations of theories where sexual development were viewed as dependent on the complex interrelation of genes, hormones, and psychological and environmental factors, where the different factors influenced each other. Other parts of the sex hormone research environment held on to the traditional conception of sexual development as something primarily determined by genes and sex hormones. Mm.
Even though Freuland and other researchers did not find any correlation between certain levels of testosterone and certain physical and psychological features in the Danish study, they recommended that individuals who were diagnosed as having XXY chromosomes were treated with testosterone from the age of 10 to 12. There are no statistics to this date of how many children and grown-ups have been treated with testosterone since then. But it is stated as a standard treatment in both older and newer literature. We have contacted the Danish State Hospital, where they have a clinic for growth and reproduction in Copenhagen, and they informed us that almost all children with XXY chromosomal condition are today treated with testosterone when they reach puberty. The physicians leave it to the parents to decide if they should be treated, and most parents apparently choose to do this. From the 1980s, persons with an XXY chromosome constitution have been normalized to a much higher degree than they were in the early research. The thesis that they were born criminals was already abandoned at the beginning of the 1970s, and the majority of persons with XXY chromosomes are considered to be of normal intelligence. Physical examination showed that the chromosome constitution far from always led to development of so-called abnormal physical features. The only consistent finding has been small testicles and a high incidence of infertility. Today, individuals with XXY chromosomes are still described as suffering from an abnormal chromosomal condition. The research which Anders Frøland and other researchers made in the 1970s contributed to the development of methods with which physicians could decide the chromosome conditions of fetuses, and these became the basis for the prenatal diagnosis practice. The idea behind the practice of prenatal diagnosis was that parents should be able to choose if they wanted the pregnant woman to have an abortion, if the fetus had a so-called abnormal chromosome condition. In instances where fetus had an XXY chromosome condition, the physicians have not counseled patients to have an abortion, but they have left it to the parents to decide for themselves if they wanted to have the child. However, surveys of the number of terminations of pregnancies with fetuses with XXY chromosomes from the Danish Central Register for Cytogenetics show that the number of abortions in the period of 1974 to 2008 was 66.8 on average, percent of on average in the period. In numbers, this means that 145 out of 217 fetuses were terminated. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So
exactly.
It was,
yes. Despite the fact that physicians in the genetic counseling did not advise parents to have an abortion, it might be the case that the description of the fetus's chromosome condition as an anomaly or abnormal development, together with the information of a high incidence of infertility among persons with XXY chromosomes, have influenced different women's and couples' decisions to get a termination. And this dilemma has been and is still discussed in research literature about genetic counseling, and there are also a lot of discussions among physicians and in the public.
So, in this talk we have shown some of the elements and processes that have been important for the construction of an association between testosterone and masculinity in the research on testosterone in Denmark. And we have attempted to show some of the consequences this research has had for individuals in society. Central elements in this history was the preconceptions about what gender and sex were among sexual biologists in the 1920s, and the aim of the research to cure and prevent sexual abnormalities for the benefit of both individuals and society. These two elements have been of great importance for the naming and gendering of a certain chemical substance found in bodies. And this, again, has been of great importance for the use of this chemical substance for the treatment of different ailments. That the researchers have been working from these understandings and aims did not mean that the researchers just found what they were looking for. The bodies they have examined have been active in the construction of concepts of masculinity in the sense that the experiments the researchers performed on the different bodies or the chemical substances in the bodies have not always just confirmed their hypotheses, but also disproved them. And bodies have shown surprising results in the history of sex hormone research, which have compelled researchers to revise their views on sex hormones and gender in general, and testosterone specifically. The results from the 1930s, for example, made the researchers change their views on gender from a perception of two more or less pure gender categories to a perception of gender as a spectrum where different individuals have different combinations of masculine and feminine features, and where you can see there's one extreme where there's the most feminine and the other extreme where there's the most masculine. And this way, the researchers' conceptions and concepts about gender have influenced their research, and the results of the research have influenced their views on gender and masculinity. And with that, we would like to just conclude with questions and discussion. Thank you.